the Prevention and Control Branch. He's a professor of medicine at the University of North Carolina. I think he's one of the most thoughtful, expansive thinkers in the field of STD prevention today, which is why we gave him this impossible task.
It is impossible. And so I've been becoming a fan of David Brooks, even though I don't agree with him on all his political views. And he coined a term that I will still call epistemologic modesty, which is that you sort of have to recognize the limits of your knowledge and what you don't know. And what all of this sort of shapes for me is the fact that there's a lot that I didn't know coming into this. It's changing my thoughts, which are great, which means that some ideas that I had even 5 minutes ago keep evolving into new places. The challenge is, how do you take that and operationalize it? I don't have a simple answer, and there's a lot, as the last question sort of addressed, that we just don't know yet. It doesn't mean, though, we can't act on that. It doesn't mean it shouldn't change the way we've been doing things. You know, we talk about HIV a lot in this conference, and I think there are some real lessons to learn from the HIV world, that people didn't sit and wait to take actions when they thought, you know what, this makes sense, we've got some data to go on, let's begin to change how we do things. And in STDs, we've actually bought into much of a medical model. So I'll get into that in a little bit. Just a couple of freelance thoughts about tying these things together. I'm glad the question was brought up about prolonged puberty, because one of the things from Dr. Rupp's talk that really sort of struck me is, how does this tie into some of the risky behaviors that we see? And how does it tie into chronic disease? And Dr. Frieden's focusing a lot on chronic diseases, and there's a lot of national attention, as this administration and Mrs. Obama has taken on, obesity. We have an obesity epidemic in the country, which is prolonged puberty. It's had probably more profound impact on minority communities in which we see obesity at a younger age. We don't know the impact of that over time. But it would suggest to me that there's a longer vulnerable period for all sorts of visual social stimuli before cognitive thought really can kick in to respond to that. So if you talk about risk-taking behavior, what's the worst case scenario? You have 12 or 13-year-olds who can be imprinted on a society with mass marketing that hyper-masculinizes all sorts of things to sell products. You turn on any TV show and you see, especially addressed to minority communities, what are very hyper-masculine images. And yet we wonder about risk-taking behavior. So I don't know the answer to that, and I certainly don't want to further stigmatize communities by saying it's different, but we have to say, gee, maybe there's unintended consequences of chronic diseases, fast food, obesity around STDs that we didn't draw the link to, and we really need to explore that. There is an opportunity to be able to say, maybe we should be working on a social marketing campaign to counteract some of the masculine or risky rewards that are out there. The idea that men with big cars, big houses, lots of bling are somehow sexually attractive in some of these communities, particularly where the proximity to STDs, and I'll come back to that, puts people at risk, needs to be addressed. And so a social marketing campaign very specifically to targeted communities where we see this disparity may be very important. The other take-home point, though, was that the idea that somehow behavior is different within groups, we actually aren't that much different. It's the proximity to risky behavior that really may be driving this. And so we do further risk stigmatizing minorities by talking about promiscuity or behavior when, in truth, the vast majority of folks of different racial and ethnic groups ain't a whole lot different than the majority population. And so one of the things I wrote down here was that we've got, which is interesting to think about, decreased number of sexual acts for low-income folks, but increased number of partners. And you have a higher concentration. So what does that do? We talk about being gonococcus and trying to get to the back of the room. It puts you at closer proximity to risk. And because you've shortened the duration of time, if you have an STD that enters into that network with partner change being more frequent, you facilitate transmission. So all of a sudden, I'm about 20 feet closer to the back, and there's about 5 more doors to get out of the room. Or if we want to get away from the white blood cells, I'm further away from those things that provide protection. It's a different way of thinking. Now, what does that translate into action? Well, we'll try to get there. Now, if you are a fruit fly who is ovulating, you might find this picture erotic. It's a pornographic fruit fly slide, and I'm only putting this up there because what it would suggest is that we ain't that far away from everything else. So let me explain this. Fruit flies produce pheromones, and pheromones attract male of the same species, but it also, in this bottom part, causes males of different species to not be attracted to that female. So this fruit fly here on the top part of the panel is actually putting out pheromones, attracts the male, and this male is licking the female genitalia before copulating while actually producing a song with its wings. So it turns out that fruit fly behavior is not a whole lot different than most male behavior. And I just found out from Dr. Rupp that there's apparently bats also have oral sex, so I'd got to get a picture of that. That would be worth. But the framework for this is really sexual health. We've had a very biomedical approach. I won't read all of this to you, but the fact is that the World Health Organization actually has a definition about sexual health, and I don't know of too many states, if any, that have some sort of definition about sexual health. It was really refreshing this morning to hear Kevin talk about sexual health, but we need to have a definition that the CDC embraces as well that's sort of out there incorporated. But if you read that lengthy thing, you actually find only the first sentence actually describes what is sexual health. The rest of the definition describes the conditions required for sexual health to exist. So if we really want to actually produce something, the definition tells you that you've got to go beyond just talking about sex. You have to deal with all the other things that are there that contribute to it. Now, I won't spend much time talking about the Ad Health study, but it really is striking to me when you look at the data, the differences that are based on race. But as you scratch down below from the two previous talks, it really gets you to realize that it's not just about sex. In fact, it's very little to do about sex. It's all the other conditions that are there. So if you look at chlamydia and you look at distribution, it's pretty obvious that if you're a minority population, the rates are much higher, and I'm not going to read all this to you. If you look at GC, it's striking in a different way to see the same thing. These are adolescent population-based surveys. And going back to what was talked about before in terms of types of behavior, where we see chlamydia in the white adolescent population is associated with high-risk activities. So if you look at this, the highest rates of chlamydia are associated with what are considered high-risk activities. For African-Americans, normative behavior results in higher risk across the board. So if we keep talking about risk reduction in a population where most of the folks who are infected actually aren't engaging in high-risk activity, it's nonsense. It's a waste of time and money. So we really need to take a different approach. Furthermore, it's stigmatizing to the population we're trying to reach, both in terms of getting the majority population to buy into something that isn't true, but also further marginalizing a population we're trying to reach and bring into the system for treatment, care, and support. Now, it was great, actually, that Hunter spoke previously, because I found one of his studies that was done looking at sort of the same things in terms of distribution, but geographic distribution of STDs. I won't spend much time on it. But it was really helpful that you went through Gini curves, Lorenzo curves, Lorenzo distribution, Gini curves, to try to understand clustering. I had to go back through a whole bunch of papers to try to figure this out because it was new to me. But the bottom line here is that if there's equal distribution, you will see that everything approaches a straight line. The more clustering, the more it sort of moves away. So if you look at this and you look at four different STDs, primary and secondary syphilis, gonorrhea, chlamydia, and general herpes, and this is King County in Seattle, you can see that you've got much more clustering associated with syphilis and gonorrhea, and less so for chlamydia and herpes. And if you look at the geographic distribution, you can also see the same thing. But within those communities, again, the population at greatest risk is going to be different in terms of those folks that are sort of core members and transmitters. But what I'm trying to move towards here is that maybe our approach needs to be different depending on the STD. So geographic clustering is certainly there. It's something that a lot of us have. We can map and put things on a map. I think that's an important first step, but we frequently end there. And I've yet to see an effective thing in which we map something around STDs that have resulted in significantly lowering rates of STDs. We have to go beyond that to figure out how to get to the population we need to get to in those areas. And it has to go beyond a biomedical approach. So the differences in the duration of infectivity and the efficacy of transmission certainly plays a role in this clustering. And the differences in terms of the population's medical coverage plays a big role as well. We have to also acknowledge, though, that racial segregation and income segregation has contributed to this clustering. So if you look at where we're seeing folks, you could look at all sorts of markers, and people are segregated. So if you're a minority population and have fewer partners to choose from, we reduce the proximity to this group of very tightly clustered folks. if we remove the men from the society through violence, incarceration, you destabilize relationships and increase the proximity to folks who are at higher risk. If you couple that with messages to a young group of women for assuming risk with the belief that the reward may be greater, especially in a society in which there isn't much hope of being connected to anything else, then you begin to actually see this facilitation of transmission within the society. If we look at North Carolina, so we move for somewhere else besides Seattle to say there are STDs, we have resurgent syphilis in North Carolina. 50% of our syphilis cases are in three counties from last year. It is highly concentrated. And so if we look at all this, we say, well, the diseases are concentrated. What about behavior? And we've seen that. But I do think there's a differential effect for gonorrhea and syphilis, probably HIV as well, that's somewhat different than diseases that are much more prevalent in the society. So our approach may have to be very different, how we spend our dollars and how we do screening. But we tend to have a one task for everything. We just do screening. We're going to roll out. We're going to test everyone. We're going to treat them. We're going to get rid of the infection. That may be a much more effective strategy where the disease is more evenly distributed and normative behavior drives it. If we have a vaccine, of course, we're going to do that for HPV and we vaccinate everyone. But if that's our approach with limited resources for diseases that are highly clustered and driven primarily by all the other factors, we will never get there. And the failure of syphilis elimination, I think, illustrates that beyond anything. What happened? Well, guess what? We did lower the rate of syphilis in the Southeast. You could argue it was a success, and I'll talk about that tomorrow in a talk. But we never got rid of the organism, so we never will. Elimination has only happened for one organism in the entire world in the history of mankind, that's smallpox. So the idea that we would eradicate or eliminate is not going to happen. So if you don't change what's there, what are the underlying driving structures, that infection will come roaring back. And indeed, that's what's happened with syphilis. Different population now with MSM in the Southeast as opposed to heterosexual, but the same dynamics are there. So we've looked at some of our syphilis data. I've got Irene Doherty looking at sort of mixing and networks. And within our networks, we do see some factors that might be worth looking at. Age distribution was one that we found very distortive in terms of mixing. So if you say, well, if you go and how do you identify this group, maybe one of the things we would look at is to go within groups with disease and try to understand what are the other factors that are there. And certainly, age differential seems to be an issue. I don't know whether or not that would work in terms of intervention, but it's something very simple that could be translated. So again, highly concentrated sexually transmitted infections such as syphilis and gonorrhea may require different control and prevention strategies for more diffusely distributed STIs. Suggests that maybe where we should be putting behavioral intervention is where we want to move beyond test and treat, and that is for these more concentrated STDs. And the question is, how do we translate clustering into effective interventions? So what do we do about that? I think that geographic targeting helps us to understand where to go, but doesn't get us to the population. So it may be a good first step, but we need to do more. It doesn't allow us to actually reach folks, though, if we just see where they are on the map. We have to integrate STI screening and care into community-based clinics. Interesting literature on prostate cancer and why minority males have higher rates of prostate cancer. And one of the things I sort of gleaned, which is an indirect thought, is that individuals who don't have a medical home are more distrustful of the system and less likely to come in. Well, where do we drive many of the minority populations who have high rates of STDs? Where do they get their care? They're uninsured, they don't have primary care providers, they come into a public health system that's viewed as government and something they don't trust. I mean, frankly, the legacy of Tuskegee is still there. So we've actually set ourselves up that we are referring people into a system that there's automatically some disdain and distrust for to begin with. It's not surprising then that if we don't go horizontal, and I'll talk more about that in our approach, I just think we're not going to get to where we need to get to for our highest risk population that feels pretty marginalized. We should have, I think, much more targeted social marketing. So we talk about everyone needs to know their HIV status without actually drilling down deeper and deeper to where we need to go. The MSM initiative is really critical. It's going to be specific and may be explicit to try to reach the population we need to get. If you're not willing to take a chance, we're not going to get anywhere. And so having a nice population-based, acceptable message to the whole population may not be effective to get to the folks we need to reach. And then finally, we have to have partnerships to address the contextual factors. I'm not equipped to go and deal with all the other issues that are there, whether it's imprisonment or where the liquor stores are or how far it is to get to a primary care provider, but we should figure out who are our natural partners so we can advocate. The challenge around STDs is we have, I don't know, some 30-some sexually transmitted infections. So when you go up to Capitol Hill to advocate, it's hard to find folks that are out there advocating against primary syphilis. But there are people that care about, you know, reproductive rights, about social justice, and we should find a way of partnering with them. We're not going to lose our message, but we may be able to deal with the contextual factors that are there at the same time. How do we bring our services to them? So prevention and control are based on five major strategies. This is taken out of the STD treatment guidelines. It's not to knock the treatment guidelines, and I won't read all of these, but if you read this through, and this is what we've bought into in public health, it is very vertical. And what do I mean by vertical? Well, we implement everything through government and local state health departments, usually with a fixed medical home. And I understand that lots of us do outreach in the communities, but it really is a test and treat model. The idea that you find a disease, you treat it, and it goes away. And if you find enough of these things and you treat it, we'll get rid of it. And as I've said, if you don't deal with the underlying problems, we will never get rid of these diseases until we have 100% effective vaccine out there for this. We have to go horizontal, but what does horizontal mean? Well, it really is on several levels. Population and community level, meaning we have to actually find partners that are acceptable and trusted within the communities that actually have contact with the people we're trying to reach. We have to put this in the right social health, sexual health, and deal with contextual issues around that, and really get this to be integrated, not a standalone issue. So if we're talking about doing something, the idea we're only going to go out and do chlamydia screening, and that's what we're going to market, probably not going to work for people who don't believe that they have those STDs. Now, this is my own simplified mock-up, but we spend a lot of our time here when really the interactions with the organism is really not just on the individual, but community and driven and protected by societal influences. So we've got to get beyond this sort of relationship and recognize if we want to get to the organism where it's harbored, we have to really address these other issues. Tom Farley back in 2006 put a model which hasn't got enough attention, and because it's complex. I mean, you look at it and you go, geez, this is pretty overwhelming. But what he really does lay out very nicely in this article and with this diagram is that STDs are sort of the long end of all sorts of contextual factors that are there. You could look at this and use it as a template about who we should be partnering, whether it's with Job Corps or dealing with incarceration sentences. Those aren't natural partnerships for us. It's going to require time, and it's going to have to be justified, I think, at state and local levels that we have to take a new approach, a new construct, a new way of thinking about it. And then the last sort of several issues here, stigma. I went back and looked at what the definition of stigma is, and I really hadn't thought about it in this way, that it can be a mark or sign of disgrace, discredit, or infamy. It also had more historical things about markings resembling, you know, crucified Jesus with Francis of Assisi. But the point here is that if you really look at stigma itself, it's a way of saying it's them, not us. Well, most of our sexually transmitted infections are asymptomatic until end stage, especially with diseases like HIV. And what I have heard over and over again in dealing with young men is that it's always somebody else. They can engage in all the high-risk behavior that's out there, and they don't think it's them. And when I ask them about partner choices, what I hear is that, well, the guy looked fine, looked good, whatever. And it's because we have stigmatized groups, or we have stigmatized diseases. So unless we're willing to move beyond that, what happens is people believe that this person looks fine because it's such a horrible thing to be labeled in many of our communities as being gay or effeminate. I mean, just look at the Olympics in terms of what happened with the American skaters. It says that, you know, we've got a long way to go. We've come a long way. We still have a long way to go. But STDs are stigmatized in and of themselves. So you wonder why people don't recognize risk. It's because they've labeled it as having in somebody else, some other group, and there's lack of recognition that maybe this person is really someone who could carry the disease because it's stigmatized. So how do we do that? I don't know. I don't know the answer how we destigmatize this, but moving towards a sexual health model moves us away from disease. It's about being healthy. It's a little bit easier to embrace that than talking about, well, I don't want to get chlamydia. So, in the last part, tying this together in terms of choices, and I stole this from Dennis, and he scribbled that on a napkin for me, we have to begin to understand and deal with, and I think Dr. Rupp's talk really helps, that the motivation for partnering is something we haven't really addressed from an STD control standpoint, but it's universal, and there's nothing wrong with that, but understanding it may help us to figure out how to unlock these very complicated pieces. Partner identification means that how people make choices may not be healthy. So beginning to actually form cognitive awareness and maybe having campaigns that really extend to chronic diseases to say, look, because you feel a certain way doesn't mean you need to act on it. We're sort of getting there around food and smoking. You know, you don't have to have the Big Mac just because you feel like eating it. Once in a while, it's not bad, but all the time is not good. But we haven't had open dialogue around sexuality to say that just because you feel like having sex doesn't mean you're a bad person, but you don't necessarily have to have it with this person right now. And how do we do that in a way that allows us to actually get cognitive awareness? If it's about bad choices, we need to get folks to recognize that maybe during certain times of the month, maybe at certain ages, you need to step back and wait. Find partners to talk to before you actually begin to engage in activity with someone else. But that also has implications in terms of how we do our intervention. We're very downstream in terms of partner notification. It was talked about earlier, and Hunter addressed this, that the majority of our funds around STD prevention are with partner-related services. But because of all the other factors that are there, how people name partners doesn't necessarily translate with whom they're having sex. And so if we focus on PCRS and EPT and we say this is all partner-related, again, we miss critical pieces of maybe the highest risk folks that are very intermittent in that connection around sexual networks. So to illustrate that point, we looked at an outbreak in Cumberland County with syphilis and looked at our syphilis network. And this was a county that exploded within 1 year from going to the lowest rate, one of the lower rates of syphilis in a county, to within a year having the second highest rate of syphilis in North Carolina. If you look at the sexual networks, and I won't go through network analysis, most of these are sort of open connections, which would suggest not sustaining transmission. However, and we couldn't connect all the dots. However, when we went back and looked at social relationships here, we could tie almost all of these cases together, suggesting that there really is something here. Now, whether or not these are sexual partners or just social partners, I don't know, but there really is something to say if you get to the right geographic area, you have to move beyond sex and begin to deal with social environment and relationships. And it may be only that it's the proximity factor that you're putting folks at connection or higher association with people that maybe they don't understand the connection is there, but we can get to that group by working through social networks. Same thing if we look at egocentric networks. We've done mapping, but then we've recognized that we have to get to venues. And if we look at the college outbreak that we had in North Carolina with acute and recent infection, again, a complicated slide, we could tie together cases through looking at either schools, websites, or bars and say we could tie people together. Those are places where we can go, maybe not to do testing and treatment, but to do education and other types of intervention. So, like politics, all sex is local. You can think about that. Our sexually transmitted infection inequities are not about sex. Ultimately, sexual health is a rights-based issue, and I think we have to begin to frame it that way or we're never going to make progress. And programs really must address contextual factors and move into partnerships with community. If we have to drive that through funding or changes in how we distribute money, we should do it. I think it's going to take a bold move to do that. So I'm going to acknowledge the folks from whom I've stolen ideas or diagrams. I don't have all the answers, there's no simple answers, but I think there's a way forward, and we should be asking more questions. Thank you.
Wow. So we have some time for discussion, for questions, for some interaction with this group. You can address them generally or specifically. The room mics are out of order, so you'll just have to speak loud. We'll repeat the question over our mics so that everyone can get it. But please use this as a time to process some of the thoughts that this might have raised for you in really hopefully reframing the way you think about the importance of partners, how partners are obtained, and what those partnerships mean to the individuals that we deal with and to the infections that we're trying to identify, treat, and prevent. Please.
I think, you know, the question came up one of the things that struck me yesterday when we was hearing Jeff Levy was about what are the metrics? How do we measure what we do? And we've been sort of stuck in measuring rates and looking at whether the rates go up or down. So in some ways, I wonder if we can get there by demanding a different set of metrics, because then you're not defining how you do it, and you're moving away from saying, well, this is not politically acceptable, to actually saying, we want to see certain things, or we're going to measure what the outcome is in a different way. It may be incremental, but I think that redefining how we're going to measure this may allow more creativity. The second thing is, I am beginning to rethink this idea that I think that policy changes allow us to be able to unroof and do things, but it's not going to fix what happens. And ultimately, it can't be, as I've said, vertical in terms of delivery. It has to be horizontal. So allowing more freedom on the ground about how local communities could use that, and saying we want to see some partnerships, but not being too defining and saying here are the metrics that we want with that, you give more creative boundaries around that. The second, for more difficult issues, maybe we could inch out demonstration projects that would allow areas to show that these sort of quote-unquote politically risky events really do pay off with some changes. So it's not that we don't think big and try to take bigger approaches, but we may have to face the practical reality that sometimes some of the changes are going to have to be incremental, and we begin to move forward that way. But I think freedom on the ground and changing how we measure might help.
Could you make any sense of that at all? You couldn't hear. So
when you reframe
they couldn't hear you. So I think what Sebgi is asking here is how that, if I understand this, that what she's really reflecting on from all of this is that so much of this reflects social determinants of infection risk, and that the focus that we've had in the past on individual behavior has probably led us to a limit. I'm interpreting this. That we've made certain amounts of progress, but we've probably come to the limit of that progress. The response that I would like to raise for Heather to address is whether or not within those social contextual aspects that we're talking about that are both physical in terms of stress environments, high risk loads, and social for a variety of reasons, is there any reason to believe that exposure to those differentially changes the way individuals' brains respond to reward and risk in ways that might also correlate to some of the findings that Jamie presented? I'm asking you to speculate because I think that we're pushing the data here.
Yeah, I think these are great questions. I agree completely with what you've said. I think it is the greater environment that leads to group vulnerability, but I think what the individual does within that environment is where the hormones come in. But I think, I don't know if I'm addressing your question, but in terms of these clusters, I would think related to what Peter said, the marketing, so the priorities, the goals of an individual could be very much influenced by the context in which that person is in, the cluster in which they're in. So Dennis's group of adolescents in Indianapolis, for them being 15 and having a baby is not a bad thing or not a punishment. So the risks of the hormonal context of mid-cycle seeking a partner for genetic fitness, in that case, we might see that as risky for them. It's rewarding. And so I think the cluster of social, cultural factors interacting with the individual hormonal factors is sort of a perfect storm of risk in the way we see risk. I don't know if I answered your question, but I think there's more to be discovered.
Yeah, and I think
discovered.
What we're beginning to explore is whether the experience of those things within that context then changes the way those rewards are evaluated 3 months later or 6 months later as a consequence of the experience that they've had.
Well, and I would add, you know, getting back to the issue about sort of these high-risk connections and what we may not be able to do, it may be that there's some very subtle changes that would be addressed early in life. And we focus sort of on adolescence, and by that point, it's probably pretty late. So the question is more of a neurobiology issue, I think, for me, is where does this sort of imprinting or change take place, and should we be focusing on maybe some things that aren't so controversial with kids, or that early infancy thing. So again, partnering in a different way and beginning to say, well, we're going to set the stage up for a 10 or 15 year change. We can blanket that actually by moving towards a sexual health or in a prevention model as opposed to disease. Because if you were talking about, well, great, you're going to do an intervention, you're going to ask the government to put money into it, and it's going to take you 20 years to see the outcome, ain't going to happen. And this is how we set ourselves up for failure, because we count beans and look at the dollars per case, and as the dollars per case goes up, as the case rate goes down, the will to actually put money in it gets pulled out. So there has to be some additional benefit. And I don't know what those connections are, but I think there's a way forward, and I'm excited about the data because it suggests that maybe we should be looking in a different place for this, and that comes back to context.
We are running close to the end of our time. There's one more question or comment, please.
Yeah, it's kind of a comment. I just come from a rural area, and the whole thing about dollars per case, and why I'm most familiar with HIV, but watching the migration of HIV to more rural areas, and in part because there was no dollars, yep. No concentration. So we don't have clusters per se. You know, I looked at the data where I'm from.
This this comes back to the converse, is that if you're looking for, well, the question was that he's from a rural area in which the disease rates around, especially HIV, were low, so he didn't have dollars going in. Now the HIV rate's going up. And that's the problem with the disease model, is the money goes where the disease is and doesn't address the underlying issues that lead towards transmission. So if we move away from that as our as one of our focus, not that we shouldn't have sort of interventions where there's high rates, but if you begin to say we should be able to look at these other factors in terms of behavior or societal structures, we can put money into those areas to begin to see changes before an organism enters into that network or population. And that's why I think there's a way forward here to say, well, we're not going to be just chasing our tail all the time. We may actually be able to do real prevention for the first time. But we didn't know where to do it or even how to even think about it.
I really want to thank everyone for this afternoon. I think we tried something that was challenging to see if we could get somewhere that's even more challenging. I appreciate your participation in it. I really appreciate our three speakers for giving us their time and their thoughts, and please join me in thanking them.